Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today we have a really special follow-up radio show with Kevin Annett, and I would like to just give you a little bit of a brief background on him, as I did before. If you want more information, you can always go up to the Galactic Connection page at the BBS radio show profile, and you'll have even more information up there. But as many of you know, Kevin Annett is an internationally acclaimed whistleblower, truly, and a Nobel Prize nominee. He also established the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State in 2010, and was very, very effective in deposing one pope and now threatening that of another. So we have a lot of good information to review tonight to see what kind of victories Kevin has achieved in the last week or so. And right now, he's ratcheting up a campaign to permanently disestablish the Vatican as a convicted transnational criminal body that openly traffics people, you know, children, and protects child rapists. So if you want any more information, please feel free to drop it there. But every moment is precious with Kevin. He's on the road. I'm very honored to speak to him today. And we have a lot to go over. So, Kevin, hello, hello, hello. How are you?
I'm doing really fine. Thanks, Alexandra. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you too. And I'm glad we finally got this together. We had a lot of interference, everybody. Nobody's surprised about that, right? But I wanted to start out with, you know, you put out a very interesting article, the Slung Stone called The Truth and Its Consequences, Living in a Post-Goliath World. I thought that was really fascinating. I kind of wanted to start out with, you were mentioning how your battle has been won, and you're kind of like in that stunned phase of, you know, do I really truly believe that this has happened? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was very graphically shown to me just this last week in an anecdote I shared in that article. I should mention to folks that you can follow all of the stuff at our website, itccs.org. But anyway, that anecdote described how just a few days ago before I left Vancouver, I met with a retired, fairly senior member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. That's, for people who don't know, that's kind of Canada's political police, the ones who historically were responsible for many of these crimes, including against Indigenous children. And this man said that there is a standing notice to all RCMP officers not to go near me. And the reason is because they're very worried about these stand-down orders that our common law court issued against all the agents of the Crown and the Vatican.
Wow.
And in his words, he says, we know what we did. In other words, they knew they were guilty of these crimes, and they understand the power, even if most citizens don't, they understand the power of a common law verdict that says that you are not obligated to obey the orders of criminals in high office. The Nuremberg legal precedents after World War II say that. The International Criminal Court says that. UN or international law says that. That the police, the judges, the soldiers, the members of parliament, and the congressmen, and all these people who are serving criminal bodies are obligated and, in fact, ordered by the citizenry to stand down if they're going to obey the orders of those criminal bodies. So they understand if push came to shove, they'd be in a very bad situation. So they're not going near this at all. And that, when people often say, well, what good can you do? That is the good that we're doing. We are shaking these institutions to their foundations, and not just legally, but spiritually. There's a big battle going on, you know, as in earth, also in heaven. And the real nature of these false churches and these institutions that kill children and traffic in them, they're being exposed. The mask is slipping. I was on the phone this evening with a woman in South Dakota who said, not only has she left the Catholic Church because of what we've exposed, but she's going to all of the members of her congregation and telling them, if you're still going to go to this church, don't pay any money. And they're starting to do that. They're circulating a petition saying, we didn't realize that our church had a policy protecting child rapists among priests who rape kids.
That is
so
great.
Yeah. They're in an uproar. So this shows you how this big wave of change is happening. And, you know, it's very exciting to be part of.
Well, it apparently you kind of started all of this in the year 2000, right? I mean, it looks like that's about when you started really breaking into the whole child trafficking, correct?
Well, it happened a few years before that, when I was a clergyman, minister on the west coast of Canada. But in the year 2000, I first published a lot of the accumulated evidence that I had gathered over the previous 3 or 4 years. And it was a book. In February 2000, I published a book called Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust, which described the massive death rate in the residential school based on government documents, you know, of a constant death rate of over 50%, you know, for much of the 20th century in these Indian schools. I published that in the year 2000. Finally, last month, for the first time, the Canadian government acknowledged, yes, tens of thousands of children died. So, I mean, you know, it took them 14 years, but it shows you that, you know, the power of truth and persistence that, yeah, it does move mountains.
Yes, and your amazing dedication and tenacity. You know, you have such a reputation out there, and you really truly are showing the rest of us what it is to win a victory because you see that light at the end of the tunnel. You never give up, and I just honor you for that. You know, I'm so grateful to be talking to you tonight.
Now, thank you. I just need to say something about that, though. That why wouldn't anyone, when you know something is wrong, why wouldn't you continue to oppose that wrong or continue to speak about the truth? You know, to me, that's just a normal moral behavior by a human being.
Totally agree.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I don't think I'm doing anything unusual. I just think I'm doing what any moral person should do.
Well, I think it's your fearlessness, too. You know, you just have that, you have that knowingness that no matter what you're here to do, you've got to get this done.
Oh, yeah.
You know, every time I speak to you, you're so committed to your mission and your cause. And, you know, I want the rest of my audience tonight to really hopefully have that ignite their missions.
Right, exactly. That's why I'm doing this. I'm not a one-man show. I don't want to be a hero. I want everybody to get on board with this.
Exactly.
Take responsibility.
Yeah. And I wanted people to notice that, you know, I thought this was fascinating. I'm looking at your background. It's, you know, apparently you were kind of a protester in many, many walks, eh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I was, as a teenager, I was very, very involved in a lot of causes. And I remember the first protest I ever did was about the, I helped organize as a high school student in Vancouver, Canada. We shut down a lot of the high schools because there was nuclear testing going off in this, in Alaska. There's an island called Amchitka, and the U.S. was doing nuclear testing there. And we went into all the high schools, pulled the fire alarms, and had 10,000 students downtown protesting at the U.S. consulate. And that was my first act. But, for years after that, I mean, I definitely see myself as, you could say, an activist. I was very involved in a lot of different kind of social justice movements, but also helping people on the ground. That's how I got into the ministry, because I'd been working in the poor part of Vancouver, doing a lot of social work and, you know, organizing people and that. So kind of naturally led into the ministry for me.
You know, at what point did a bell go off within your head? Was it during the time when you were writing your book? Or I noticed you had quite a few friends that were actually Indians that had gone through this type of torturous experience. And I was just wondering, what was the real turning point for you where you said, enough's enough? You know, it's one thing to research it and put it in a book. It's another to just go after it and bring it down.
Well, you know, I had that experience early on. The very first Native man I ever spoke to when I got to Port Alberni in 1992. The very first week I started in St. Andrew's United Church as a minister there, I met a man who had seen his best friend killed in the residential school run by my church at the time. And I knew then, look, there's something really serious here, because I kept talking to a lot of Native people. They kept telling me the same story. And, I mean, it started that early, but I think what the turn in me happened is when I went through the loss of my own children, when, you know, my wife, encouraged and actually paid by the church, left me and won custody of our daughters.
That's right.
Who were only 6 and 3 at the time.
Got it.
It was that realization, it hit me like a ton of bricks. If they could do that to me, just deliberately destroy my family like that because of what I uncovered, there's no humanity in these people. And then it made sense. Well, of course they could kill these children. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when that level of inhumanity is at work, it had to hit me personally. It wasn't just an abstraction anymore at that point for me.
Wow. Well, on to a little bit of a brighter note. Tell us a little bit about your experience this last week with the latest trial that you had.
Well, on April 7th, there was for folks who followed our work, they might remember that last year we did, as you mentioned, there was the first case of the common law court in Brussels. Now, this is a convened court that looked at a lot of the evidence of genocide in Canada. They brought in a verdict of guilty against Pope Benedict, who did resign 2 weeks in the same two-week period that our verdict came in. Queen Elizabeth and Prime Minister of Canada and other officials, they were all named. The second case has to do with global child trafficking. There's a tremendous amount of evidence. There's 16 witnesses who have already made statements to the court. And the three main defendants are the present Pope Francis, the head of the Church of England, Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, and the head of the Jesuits, a guy called Adolfo Bichon. Evidence linking all three of those men, not just in concealing and protecting child rapists and child trafficking in the Catholic and Anglican churches, but actively participating in cult ritual, you know, torture and even killing of children. And this is from eyewitnesses. These are from people in government, in church. I mean, they're really credible witnesses. And as a matter of fact, in terms of the present Pope, we have a man living in Spain in under close protection who was a member of the Argentine military junta. He was a civil servant, and he was sat in on meetings where this present Pope, Jorge Bergoglio, planned with the Argentine military how they were going to kidnap and traffic the children of political prisoners being held and killed in the jails of Argentina. And this is how Bergoglio became, you know, the head of the Argentine church, by doing that and doing other things to help the military dictatorship there. So all of this is going to be coming out in the court, and the prosecution has opened its main case. It's been presenting evidence. We sent out a posting about that. It's, again, up at itccs.org, so people can read some of this. But it's really horrifying stuff. We're talking about ritual sacrifice of children. We're talking about these cults that operate within the Catholic Church and other places. So it's kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. The more of the pieces are coming into place now.
You know, I think that the most fascinating thing in all the investigation that you've done is there doesn't seem to appear one part of our civilization that has not been infiltrated by this ring. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. The testimonies, for example, there's a woman in Holland who has actually gone public already 2 years ago. Her name is Toos Nienhuis, and she was born into this satanic network. Women are used as, quote, breeders,
yeah,
to have children, either to sacrifice the baby or to raise the children as members of the cult. She saw very prominent officials, Prince Bernhard, founder of the Bilderbergers, the royal family in England, members of the royal family, senior politicians. As a matter of fact, there was a famous case in the news involving a child serial killer called Marc Dutroux in Belgium. And when Dutroux was arrested, they found remains of children all through the basement of his house. But also evidence that senior politicians, judges, heads of UN committees, they were all involved in this. And there's a Belgian member of parliament now, Laurent Louis, who I'm actually meeting this week, and we hope to have a press conference together. He has named the Prime Minister of Belgium as being a child rapist, and he's facing criminal charges for doing that. They're really coming down on him, but he's persevering. He's got a lot of evidence linking a lot of these politicians, military people, all sorts of people with this huge industry of child trafficking.
You know, I noticed that's gotten a lot of publicity. I know I've blogged several articles about Holland and the huge child trafficking ring there. It seems to be located around the Vatican, England, and Holland. Now, is that kind of like a false sense of perception?
Well, what that indicates is where our witnesses are based. So it's kind of biased in favor of the evidence we've accumulated so far.
Okay.
But it is an international network. One of our informants in New York, who I'm actually, I've seen numerous times, she knows people who still operate within these satanic networks. And so she's got to be very careful so she's not killed, you know, disclosing this stuff. But to give you an example, they regularly, routinely at full moons, have ritual slaying of babies in Catholic cathedrals. It's always got to be in a Catholic cathedral. And she names, there's a cathedral in Montreal. There's one in right in New York City. There's places where they happen in the catacombs or the underground areas of the church. So, you know, this is widely known, but heavily protected. So, you know, it's you've got to kind of build these cases from the ground up. And under a lot of harassment and threats, we had, as a matter of fact, we learned from a source in Rome that the Vatican had dispatched a team to disrupt the court, which is why it's actually meeting under behind closed doors right now. We wanted it to be a public trial, and it may be eventually, but for now we want to protect the witnesses and the evidence primarily. So we're disclosing evidence periodically, but we've got to, you know, be aware that there's a lot of people out there involved in these crimes that don't want them brought out.
Oh, I bet. I mean, just because you literally are going for the head, you know, chopping off the head.
Yeah.
Of this whole conspiracy, you know.
That's the only way to stop it.
Yeah, exactly. And I was going to ask you, now, Jorge Bergoglio, he refused to challenge or deny any of these criminal charges, right? Is that where we still stand?
That's right. The last month, these are all YouTube postings, again, at itccs.org, we issued a public summons to the three of them, Bergoglio, Pashon, and Welby. And none of them responded. We sent them letters, registered letters, never got a response. Now, under the law, that's called nolo contender, which means we do not contest the charges. And a judge normally in a court case would say, well, then that's a tacit admission of guilt. They're not willing to defend their own good name when they're being called murderers and child traffickers. That says that they're not challenging that statement. And so it strengthens the prosecution's case tremendously. Because, you know, now they're proceeding to saying, well, we're assuming that the defendants have nothing to say in their own defense here. And so, you know, we're following legal procedure and due process, but they are, like anybody in that position, they think that they're impervious. They think they're God. They can get away with anything. But, you know, their whole system is coming apart from the ground up, and we've got a lot of indication of that all the time.
You know, I wanted you to really clarify with the public right now what has transpired within the government of Canada. I think it's just phenomenal what you were talking about regarding, you know, the flag not being in the courtroom.
Right.
With the fringe, right?
Right. Well, you know, the Canada's one example, but you find the same thing in the United States as well, recognizing that what we think are courts that are supposed to be convened under natural law, which says that the courts are really the arm of the people, not the judiciary, those courts are actually now private commercial courts that and the judges are employees of these corporations. Example of that in Canada, there are no more Canadian flags in the courtrooms. They only... authority is this crest of the City of London, otherwise known as the Crown of England. And I was in, just a couple of months ago, I was in the British Columbia Supreme Court with a group of Native elders who were, you know, fighting for their fishing rights. And I said to one of the elders, ask the judge if she's, if this is a public or a private court, and ask her for her oath of office. And he did, and each time she refused to answer, she finally said, sit down or I'll have you removed. Now, again, not contesting what's being said, why wouldn't you, if you were a public official who had taken an oath, you know, to abide by the law and to enact justice, why would you not say what your oath of office is? So these people, like you know, any de facto, you know, and there's a difference between under the law. De jure means it's lawful and just system. De facto means it isn't just or lawful, but they're a fact. Their power, like when there's a military coup and the military takes over, they're de facto power, even though they don't have any legitimate authority. That's what we're living under now, de facto rule, whether it's the church, the courts, governments. They're not accountable to the people anymore, and that's even written in any member of parliament or judge or police official in Canada, take an oath of allegiance to Queen Elizabeth and her descendants. That's it. Not to the people of Canada, not to the Constitution.
Yeah,
so they're serving a foreign corporate entity, not the people. And so we've said to them, and I constantly say this to cops, you're not accountable to us, so why should I obey any of your rulings or anything? I mean, these statutes that governments bring in, this is a really important thing people need to know. They brainwash us to think that a statute is the law and has to be obeyed. It isn't. Because if you look in long tradition in common law in England, it says a statute, which is a rule a government brings in basically to maintain themselves or to make money for themselves, like, you know, traffic tickets or whatever, these statutes only have binding authority over citizens if they consent.
Yeah.
If you don't consent, it has no authority over you. It's that simple.
Bingo.
But they never tell you that bit.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, too, you must be running up against not only death threats, but an immense amount of disinformation campaigning.
Yep.
How do you overcome that? I mean, what is your daily walk in trying to get past the mainstream media that would probably be blocking it, as well as the security and the police that they own?
Well, you know, at first I lost a lot of sleep over this because it's like trying to fight a whole nest of hornets coming at you, right? You know, whacking away at them.
Mm-hmm.
What I realized I had to do after a while is just ignore them and build up your own light, build up your own work, mm-hmm. and that creates a counterweight, which is much more powerful than anything they can throw at you. So all the smears, all of the accusations, all of the attacks that come, I just ignore, literally.
That's a good point, because it's like whatever you resist, you feed.
That's right. You're giving them your energy and power by resisting. But what they can't fight is the fact that, and here's a simple proof. I remember when I was being interviewed by, when they used to interview me, they haven't in like 5 or 6 years, the corporate media in Canada, the Globe and Mail, which is the biggest newspaper, they're interviewing me, and they said, well, how do you respond to these allegations that you've just made up these figures? And I said, well, they're not made up. These are government documents showing that 50% of these kids were dying decade after decade. That's a deliberate plan of extermination. It's random deaths. And anyway, if I was wrong, how come I've never been sued? How come the government and the churches have never taken me to court with their own counter evidence? They never have.
Wow.
Okay. Now, the proof is right there.
Yeah.
They're admitting by their silence that it's true. And I just stand on that. Show me the evidence. Let's stand on the truth. Not name-calling, not allegation or innuendo or any of this nonsense. That's all they have. It's kind of like when I was in law, in my first year, they taught you this in legal process class. They said, in a trial, if the evidence is on your side, you argue the evidence. If the evidence is against your client, attack the witness.
Mm.
That's the old lawyer's dodge.
Yep.
That's what you do. And that's what they're doing. They're attacking me, the witness, because they don't have any evidence. Oh, I have the evidence. They don't.
That's such a good point. Well, now, you also mentioned that Queen Elizabeth of Windsor, she ordered the destruction of the forensic remains of the murdered children and the archives. Have you gotten down to the bottom of that? Have you been able to recoup anything that she's tried to destroy? Or
we're getting this in bits and pieces, but we know that this goes back to two incidents. She was seen, Elizabeth Windsor, Queen Elizabeth, and Prince Philip were seen by an eyewitness taking 7 boys and 3 girls out of the Kamloops Indian School in October 1964. None of those children were ever seen again.
Oh, my God.
And the eyewitness, William Coombs, who was about to talk about it in London, died quickly in a hospital. He was given a lethal injection, we've discovered, and killed, so he couldn't testify. That was in February 2010. And I knew William. He was a friend of mine. He's one of the six who works with us in Vancouver who had been killed to get, you know, because they were eyewitnesses to these things. But the other incident had to do with 2 years ago, I was invited to come to a Mohawk, former Mohawk Indian school in Brantford, Ontario, the first school set up in Canada, set up by the Church of England. And when we were invited to start to do a testing there, we found on the grounds of the school where eyewitnesses had seen burials of children, we found bits of school clothing, bits of bones, which turned out to be children's bones. Mm-hmm. All of this fairly strong evidence that, yes, there was a grave there of children who had gone to these schools. When that evidence came out, that was January 2012, the guy who is one of the defendants in the latest case, Justin Welby, he was ordered by Queen Elizabeth to destroy that evidence, and he sent a circular to the head of the Anglican Church in Canada, a guy called Fred Hiltz. He ordered this guy to make sure all that evidence did not see the light of day. So it's obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence of a crime, all of that stuff these people are doing.
And I just, it's so ironic that it was actually the Queen herself, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, these people are all the royal member families are involved in this stuff.
Up to their eyeballs.
Yep.
Well, the other thing I wanted you to clarify for everyone is who is actually funding this, like from the top down?
Funding which?
Just the whole pedophilia ring. How does it even get to be this big?
Well, it's very lucrative, for one thing. Human trafficking is a massive industry all over the world. Just look at the figures. Over 100,000 children in America go missing every year, and that means disappeared, not just grabbed by an irate ex-parent or something, but actually vanish. We heard from a Cree Indian elder in Alberta this last week that 543 Cree Indian kids can't be accounted for in the children's aid system. That's because they're being trafficked either for sexual purposes, maybe organ, trafficking is also very big, especially in the Pacific Rim countries coming out of China, but also for these sacrificial rites. Now, we know that definitely children who are grabbed on their way to foster homes or orphanages and that are prime fodder for these sacrificial cults. So, I mean, it's, that's one aspect of it in terms of where it's coming from. I mean, the use of children for sexual blackmail purposes is a common tool of governments. The CIA admitted, there was an article in a paper in Washington, D.C. just a few years ago, that said that the CIA admitted that they run brothels in Thailand using child prostitutes to blackmail visiting senators and congressmen. You know, so they have dirt on these guys and they can control them.
Yeah.
This happens. So, I mean, it is governments, it's, you know, corporate, and especially the Catholic Church is the worst offender because they have laws that go back centuries that say when child rape happens, it's to be covered up. It's not a crime. That's what it says in this law, Crimen Solicitanus. So that's a green light. That'll attract every child rapist on the planet, knowing you can get ordained as a Catholic priest and get away with it.
Yes. We were just talking about that the other day because I was brought up Catholic, and I thought to myself, well, this is just a feasting ground.
Yeah.
Those that are imbalanced sexually.
Oh, yeah. And also it's you know, right in belief system. If you believe that children are born depraved because of this weird thing called original sin, anything can happen to these children.
So repulsive. Now, I was also really surprised to see that you mentioned the Hell's Angels, the Hong Kong Triad, and other mobsters that you've actually determined that they're fully involved in this.
Well, this is from a few witnesses in the Vancouver area who describe it. Also, there's a member of the what's called the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, Canada CIA, and he actually called me up last year and filled my ear with the fact that he had actually been part of a team that had infiltrated this place in Vancouver where children, they found the remains of Aboriginal women on the grounds of this home. And they scapegoated this one guy, his name was Willie Picton, who has a substandard IQ. They claim that he was the only serial killer. Well, he was part of the cleanup crew, but it involved many other people. And some of these witnesses were naming who these people were. And the CSIS agent as well told me that it involved very high military and political people, including several Canadian senators still in office, and, you know, foreign underworld people who, you know, they just, it's part of, like I say, the human trafficking network. So it's, you know, it's when you're working on the ground, you see this all the time. And, you know, I've been working on the streets of Vancouver since the 1980s, so I've heard all of these stories before. But again, when something is genuine coming from somebody who's experienced it, all they have is their own word. Everybody is against them. Mm-hmm. They know they'll get killed if they ever talk about it, and no reporter is ever going to report this anywhere. The editor would never let the story see the light of day. I found that, again, you know, when you said, when the media ignore this, how have I dealt with it? You've got to become your own media, which is what we've done.
Yeah. You know? Well, now, do they have, like, a specific, you know, code of how they select these children? I remember reading, oh, man, quite some time ago, there was an article that the governments, literally, like the congressmen and the House of Representatives, are very involved in this, and supposedly they have connections with other male friends who are pedophiles with their own children, and they actually sell their children to the network.
Right. Well, you know, it's like private contractors do this. There's contractors who gather children, kidnap them, keep them in houses, soundproof jails, really, and use them as meat. They're literally kept in cages and then sent out, you know, you order children for sexual purposes, for torture, for killing, for anything you want to do.
Yeah.
And one of the people I'm speaking with here on the East Coast, she has intimate knowledge of how this operates, and I'm gradually piecing together the story from her. And it's clearly a whole business that operates, you know, with full knowledge by the police, political powers, you know. And it's kind of like for every honest cop, there's another cop who's involved in this stuff. And, you know, their own code is to not rat on each other. So this is how this stuff carries on.
Now, you also made mention of the Ninth Circle. Can you comment a little bit about, you know, what is the, you know, what have you found out lately about them? I know that they go into every aspect of society, right?
Well, Ninth Circle, it's from the book Dante's Inferno. The Ninth Circle of Hell is the place where people go when you've committed a breach of a trust, a traitor, somebody who's violated an oath. That's seen as the worst sin. Well, the whole idea of the Ninth Circle is that if you take people who have taken vows supposedly to God and then get those people to kill children and violate the most basic innocence and goodness and humanity, they will acquire, in effect, satanic power
right.
through the death of those children. And this Ninth Circle goes back several centuries. Novum Corum is the name in Novum Corum, I think, unless I got my Latin wrong. Ninth Circle or... I'll have to look that up, and it was printed up on our site, the exact meaning of it in Latin. But anyway, the circle involves apparently a thing that, and this is referred to in Vatican documents, which have been entered into the court case in Brussels about global child trafficking, the one going on right now. This Vatican document refers to what they call the magisterial privilege. Now, magisterium refers to the College of Cardinals, which is the real power in the Vatican. Magisterial privilege apparently is the right of any candidate for the Pope to have to go through this ceremony by which they are raping and torturing and killing children to acquire ultimate power. And this is attested to by eyewitnesses and these documents and insiders. I mean, this is inside information that's being shared, you know, as well as people like Tos Nienhaus who witnessed it.
You know, Kevin, I almost called you last week because someone had sent me a video of the testimony of a nun. Her name is escaping me right now. I know you know who it is. She actually blew the whistle on going into the nunnery, the convent. And, I mean, after I heard that video, I was sobbing. I couldn't even sleep that night. I had no idea. And she went into grand detail as to how they take these young girls that are virgins, and it's like standard operating procedure to basically punish them until they relinquish their will to have sex with the priest.
Yeah, I
was just in shock. And then she said they have baby after baby after baby, and these babies disappear.
You know, when I was in Italy for the first time, somebody showed me this old church from like the 12th century, and it said the name of the area right in front of the church is the children's graves, because that's where they always buried the fetuses and the newborn babies that are the result of the priests raping the nuns and the nuns getting pregnant from other people. Standard practice. I mean, this goes back many centuries. And so, you know, when you look at the way I got into this, I scratched the surface. I found out about the Indian residential schools, and your first reaction is to think, oh, this is some kind of aberration. This is some horrible thing because they wanted to wipe out the Indians. No, it isn't just that. It's part of this bigger sacrificial tradition where children are not only expendable, but the blood of the innocent, and they believe this, it's right in their theology, the blood of the innocent is a source of life.
Wow. Now, are you familiar with David Icke?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, his TV network is covering a lot of our stuff, the People's Voice TV.
I was hoping, because the two of you would just have a phenomenal radio show program. Oh, my God.
Well, we're hoping to do that, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I was curious what you thought about the Archons, because you're going right into the Archontic network and the fact that they live off of human blood and child sacrificing. What is your thought on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's different, you know, it's kind of like touching the elephant. You're describing different aspects of the same beast. So I don't think anybody's wrong about, you know, we're just describing different things, dealing with the same entity. And don't forget that it continually shifts its appearance in order to fool. I mean, Jesus called them the father of lies. They live through deception because they have to operate behind this cloak, this fog of fear and appearance, so that we can't really wake up to see what they're doing and how they're manipulating the human race, and really feeding off us. I mean, it comes down to that. It's a form of energy parasitism. It's we're the I wouldn't say flock, but you know, we're the cattle in the pen.
Well,
and they're feeding off this. Yeah.
They're definitely not of this plant,
no.
You know? I mean, and they prey on us like parasites.
And they get our own people to do it. And it's amazing how easily human beings will do that to one another, as we know. But
well, see, Kevin, the thing is that a lot of the people that you're referring to, the question mark is, are they really people? Because, you know, when you really get down to the human nature, when you are coming from your divine spark, you would never even think of doing these sorts of things.
That is true. And we can lose that spark, definitely, and then we become something else. And some people call it possession. Others, you know, whatever. It's the same thing. You lose that humanity. And don't forget, you know, I mean, it's as simple as what you have to do in any corporation to rise to the top. You have to, and there's all sorts of tests that they do along the way. Best example of that I experienced was my two best friends in seminary. They were ministers on Vancouver Island with me. They were the two who were assigned to bring me down. Their mission was to bring in all these false charges against me to give the church an excuse to take me under the pulpit. And it was a test for them. And sure enough, because they were able to do that to their best friend, they then went on, and they actually hold fairly senior positions in the United Church of Canada now.
Wow.
For having done that. You know, it's like, if you can kill the innocents in yourself and in others, you've got the right stuff. You can rise up in the corporation. So, I mean, that's what the psychopathic system does. It selects for people like that, and they're the ones in charge, apparently.
My big question mark is, do they have a method to their madness? Do they have a very specific profile of the types of children that they prey upon?
On the which of children? Sorry, I didn't hear.
The types of children that they prey upon.
I think childhood generally is they want to get children as young as possible, the most innocent. They feed off that innocence, definitely. Also because children, can be frightened the most easily and terrorized.
There you go.
And something in that, in the release of that chemical in the body related to terror, they feed off. And so they want to instigate that in very young children.
That makes sense. I just was curious if it fell into the category of the Syrian race and, you know, keeping the blonde hair and the blue eyes and, you know, had they taken that to another extreme.
Well, no, they sacrifice, from what I've been able to put together and a lot of the research we're all doing, it's clear they're taking kids from every ethnic group. They really target Aboriginal communities.
And why or, is that?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because Indians can go missing and nobody cares. Because they're in Canada, they're not citizens, they're wards of the state. If you're living on reservation, you're a complete dependent on the state. So you have no legal rights. The parent cannot legally prevent. In the Indian Act of Canada, you cannot, as an Indian parent living on a reservation, you cannot stop the government if they want to put your kid in the hospital and experiment on them. That happened during the swine flu, the bogus scare about the swine flu vaccine. They were taking Native kids off reservations all through the North and shoving needles in their arms without parental permission at all, because they can do that under the Indian Act. So, I mean, a group like that is just wide open for you know, you can grab them anytime you want.
Unbelievable.
No repercussions.
Wow. So what are you seeing a significant difference in between last year and this year as far as the way in which you've been able to get through the system, get things done, people stepping forward? Have you seen a radical change from last year to this year?
Well, I've seen a shift happen. I know that it's kind of like watching a plant grow up. We've spread seeds all over, and, you know, some of the seeds have landed in good soil. And in people's minds that are open to this stuff. And those people are beginning to take action. They're beginning, I mean, we've had people, especially in the States, come forward and want to set up common law courts on a whole number of issues, like chemtrails, fraudulent mortgages. That's what we're working with the farmers in South Dakota over, the whole issue of judges colluding with mortgage companies to grab people's farms and homes illegally. That's a big one. In many of these issues, people are wanting to adjudicate in their own way, in their own community, through these common law courts. So that's directly because of the work we've been doing, because they said, well, look, if they were able to get the Pope to resign, I mean, the sky's the limit here. You know, we can do this. There's a group of mothers in New Jersey who are aiming at the Attorney General and Governor Christie for their role in aiding and abetting child trafficking right within the child care system right in New Jersey. So, I mean, people are seeing that citizens do have tremendous power once they discover that power in themselves.
Well, and that's the purpose of this interview with you tonight, is to be able to review just some of the basics. And I kind of want to segue into that next.
Yep.
You know, just to kind of pick up from where we left off last time and start from the very beginning as to, how do you set up a common law court? You know, I thought we could go through the training manual and where it starts with the rules of evidence. Do you want to go start there?
Sure. Well, I mean, just basic rules of evidence is if somebody's bringing a case about somebody, you post something called a notice of claim of right, and you're saying, you know, I'm accusing this person of this and that. I need 12 people in the community to listen. You don't have to have a position one way or the other. We want you just to listen, because people have an inherent right or inherent knowledge of right and wrong. And so you can adjudicate this matter. So the person has to be named. The evidence brought against the person, according to due process, is it can't just be innuendo or hearsay, like, yeah, well, I heard him do this. I heard that he did this. You have to bring in credible witnesses who saw something, who are not only willing to put in an affidavit about it, but will appear in court to back up that affidavit and said, yes, this is what I witnessed about the person. I mean, that's just basic due process. You know, assumption of innocence.
I was just going to say, and I think it's cool, Kevin, that the way in which the rules of evidence lie is there's a strict timeline, right?
Yeah.
I think that's cool, if you can talk a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a they have a term that judges love. It's called vexatious litigation, which means that you're bringing a lawsuit against somebody because you don't like them and you want to make their life miserable. And you often see this in family courts when parents are going after each other. They just bring on litigation because it feels good and they want to get at the person. You know, that's not the purpose of the law. And so when you're bringing a suit, there's usually a 30-day period in which it has to be, if not resolved on a one, you know, just kind of working it out in a pretrial conference, at least the adjudication begun. You can't drag out a case. If it's legitimate, you know, you wouldn't drag it out anyway. You'd want to get some kind of resolution. So there's always a time limit, definitely. It's just, you know what, Edward Coke, he was a judge back in the 1600s who took on the king and said the king is not above the law. Nobody's above the law. The law is king. And Edward Coke said common law is simply common sense writ large. Mm. And that's true. I mean, it is simply our common sense, you know, in action. That's a good summary of the common law.
Yeah, that's a good point. It you know, I remember in the old days, we all used to sit around and say, I don't really understand our court system because it takes like 3 years to get something to be heard by the judge, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Then it doesn't really matter if you receive the court date because the opposing attorney can just keep filing appeals.
Well, this is because the so-called law that exists now, the de facto court system, is a game between lawyers and judges. And in a common law court, there are no lawyers and judges. This is the point.
Yeah.
The people are the source of the law. Juries, sheriffs, traditionally, sheriffs who are elected by the community, and this is a great advantage Americans have, they have that tradition still in place. Local county sheriffs, they have the right, just as a justice of the peace do, to convene a common law court. Or any 12 citizens can. And the jury is the beginning and the end of the court. A judge is there as a magistrate, not even a magistrate. He's an adjudicator. He's an advisor on points of order, on points of law. He advises the jury, but he doesn't have the right to cancel their verdict or dispel them or to change the court record or all of this nonsense that judges can do now. And lawyers actually have no role under the common law because the lawyer represents or re-presents a person. You're casting a person in a different light when you represent them. And people can only present themselves. They should not ever be represented by another. It's like the fallacy of the notion of representative democracy. It doesn't exist. It doesn't work.
Good point.
So we can only represent ourselves, and so there are no lawyers in a common law case. The defendant and the plaintiff and the defendants are there in their own name. And if I'm not willing to be there to present a case, then that's not a legitimate case because you've got to be able to argue it. And you're advised by legal experts about how to go about it and everything. But ultimately, it's citizens working things out, you know, in that if they can't work it out among themselves, then you work it out in a common law court.
Yeah, and I have a list here. It says it's only legitimate as a trial when the accused is given their rights, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're afforded the chance to freely defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're presumed innocent, not guilty, which is completely the opposite of our court.
Right.
The burden of proof is on the plaintiff, so they have to prove guilt to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, can you talk a little bit about how is that different from our actual court system today? Because we hear that bounced around a lot, but it's not really true.
Well, because most cases are not even argued before juries anymore, and the reasonable doubt doesn't even enter into it. They're just, you know, this kind of ludicrous thing called plea bargaining. You know, the lawyers get together and say, well, just admit you're guilty and we'll reduce your sentence. It's not based on truth. It's based on manipulation. And truth, I remember my first year in law, the law teachers were all telling me the same thing over and over. They're saying that the class, this is not about truth and who's right and wrong. This is about what you can win for your client.
Wow.
That's what they were teaching you in first-year law.
Wow.
So where are the ethics? That's actually why I quit law school, because they were saying, literally, ethics play no role in the law. And I said, well, then it's not the law, is it? Because, you know, that's what the law should be, you know?
God. So, now, another thing is the accused cannot be detained without due process.
Right, that's the old, one of the pillars of common law is habeas corpus. And that means produce the body in Latin. Two aspects to that. It means you can't just throw somebody in prison indefinitely without having a trial. A very powerful tool is a writ of habeas corpus that you can present to a judge saying, you will produce this person in court today. So they cannot delay justice. It's written right there in Clause 40 of Magna Carta. It says, we will delay and deny justice to no one.
Mm.
You know, so that's, Magna Carta is very important to read because it's got all these principles 1,000 years ago enunciated right in them. And the first really act that limited the power of the crown.
Good point.
So habeas corpus, that's the first aspect. But the second aspect to habeas corpus is, if you're, and we're using this now, we are writing a writ of habeas corpus saying we want this case moved from a normal court into a common law court. And we've issued those writs against judges who are, for example, that case in South Dakota of, there's a guy in prison in South Dakota, a 77-year-old farmer, because he was challenging the judge in the rulings he was making, and the judge put him in jail for 2 years because he didn't like his attitude, right?
Okay.
So we issued a writ of habeas corpus saying, we want his case moved out of your court into a common law court convening in this community, and that's what one of the things we're working on. So these are powerful writs, and judges can't ignore these, you know. As a matter of fact, even the Supreme Court in America, Justice Scalia said the other year that the grand jury system is a fourth arm of government. It's outside the judicial system. It's a check and balance on the judges, the grand jury. Citizen grand juries are convened to investigate matters. They're not like courts. A grand jury will investigate, well, is there corruption going on? Is there a crime going on? And then their decision has binding power on judges. They say, you will now adjudicate this matter. So the grand jury system is another great bulwark, another advantage in America that other countries don't have. Most countries don't have the grand jury system along with the county sheriffs.
Well, I do feel truly like all eyes are on the United States of America. I mean,
yeah.
It is really time for us to get up off our couches and take action, because there's so many things that we could take action on in a common law court. And so I tell you what, you also mentioned, let me see, both sides are given equal time. I thought this was great. Given equal time to file statements and evidence and make motions to the court and respond to the arguments.
Well, that's right. You've got to give each side their fair time at something. So, you know, in a court, in a legitimate, lawful court, you have anything can be scrutinized. Usually you have a thing called examination for discovery, or voir dire, it means to see and say in French, where you look at all the evidence, and you can't then later introduce evidence that you haven't shown to the other side, which is actually what they did in my defrocking. After they tossed me out of the hearing, they then brought in all this so-called evidence against me that I never saw. That's totally illegal, and yet courts do it all the time. Well, that's to prevent that. We've got to give plaintiff and defendant the right to look at anything, to challenge anything. I mean, the beauty about these courts is that it's the ultimate democracy in action, mm-hmm. when you think about it. Anything can be scrutinized. Anyone can be brought into court, a king, a pope, a president, anybody, a head of a corporation, the most powerful, richest person on the planet is equalized in a common law court. I don't know any other system in our society that does that. There isn't one, frankly.
That's awesome. And then the accused must appear promptly before the court. And that's usually, isn't it within 7 days?
Yeah, it depends. Sometimes 48 hours, usually no more than 7 days. Yeah, and at that point, common law peace officer can then go and detain them if they haven't responded to the warrant.
And then, you have examination for discovery is where you can demand relevant evidence and documentation. Are there any other aspects of relevancy other than it cannot be hearsay?
It has to be verified by usually more than one person, especially in a more serious case. Like, it's important to note there's two general areas of the law, civil and criminal. So civil law is between individuals usually, damages that have been caused between individuals. And often that can be just sorted out. These are sometimes called tort offenses in the law. You know, you break somebody's window, you've got to compensate them. You know, that's civil law. Criminal law involves something having to do with issues that affect the whole community. Murder, rape, genocide, corruption in the government, things like that, acts of war. These are criminal acts. And there's a different standard at work. Because, for example, if you just do a crime as an individual, the law requires two things to have happened. You have to commit an act, and you have to have intended to commit the act. Okay?
Okay.
Act and intent. Both have to be there for a conviction to happen. So if, you know, people often get off by saying, well, they did this act, but they didn't intend to do it. Okay? You need both of them together. But if you're a government planning the extermination of another group of people, you don't have to prove that every single agent of the government intended to do that because they're following the rules, right?
Right.
So there's an implied intent. If you're operating the system, best example is if you're a Catholic priest, you're ordained, you know that under the law, canon law, crimen solicitanus, you have to cover up child rape or you'll be excommunicated. That's a criminal conspiracy involving every Catholic priest on the planet. Mm. They will collude in protecting child rapists if they're going to keep their status as priest, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
That's involvement in a global criminal conspiracy that's harming and killing children. So there doesn't have to, they're all involved in that. There's an implied intent there, even if one priest doesn't intend to go and do it. They're involved in a collective crime, right? So you see there's a different standard when you're talking about a criminal act and maybe just a civil act, right?
Yes. You know, not to segue away, but I just have to ask you this. Are each of the priests aware of this ritual with the nuns? You know, I mean, are there any priests, are there any convents out there that don't do this type of stuff? I mean, is it just that particular convent that I heard about that was just absolutely atrocious?
No. Of course everybody knows. I mean, the point is, yeah, let's say you're a newly ordained priest. You learn very quickly. And that's why there's a lot of ex-priests and ministers out there, because the honest people can't hack this, and they quit or they get booted out like I was. So the system tends to weed out the decent people, and the people who are left in there, who, especially if you become a bishop or a cardinal or a pope, you can only get into that position by enforcing the policy, and you know full well what's going on. So all this babble that Jorge Bergoglio is doing these days, saying, oh, he talks out of both sides of his mouth. The Pope Francis says, oh, there's no organization besides the Catholic Church that deals with its own crimes the way the Catholic Church does. And then he turns around and agrees with the Italian bishops when they announce they will not report child rape to the police. So which is it? Are they going to report or aren't they? You know, they can say anything they want because they're a self-governing institution, right?
Wow.
They're not accountable to anybody, and that's the purpose of common law is, yes, you are accountable. Catholic priests are accountable under the law, as is the Pope, and that's why he's on trial at the moment.
You know, I had a mentor once share this with me. I just shared it with a friend of mine the other day, and it really helped. And he said, there's three types of people on the planet. You have people that are very, very dark, and those that are dark are very obvious. And then you have people that are very much of the light, and they're very obvious by their intentions and their, you know, their joy and, you know, their love. And then you have people that are gray. And he said, so which ones do you think are the most dangerous? And I said, well, the dark. And he says, no. He said it was the gray, because they will be able to use the light to cloak themselves for the true intention of what they're here to do.
Yes, that's right, and the epitome of that is the church, because that's historically where a lot of these crimes come out of, because of exactly that going on. I mean, if you talk about, and I see this ad nauseum in Canada now, people say, who are in the church, well, it's true that these crimes happened, but we gave money, and we gave an apology, and we did the right thing, now we can feel good about ourselves, and you know. And then I say to them, well, if it was your child lying in the ground somewhere, what would you want? Money from the person who did it?
Well, it's not even just the child lying in the ground. What about everything that they did to the child?
Well, exactly. That's the whole point.
The child, at least, is in some sort of rest, you know, being dead.
Well, that's right. And the reality, of course, is that this stuff is happening as we speak. And, you know, you can look at any Catholic church and, you know, there's, or any church really, and, you know, there's torture going on there of children, and it's being covered up at every level. And, you know, I say there's this numbness about the whole thing.
Yeah.
That I find mind-boggling. I've spoken at, you know, Occupy, you know, I spoke at Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Toronto, all these different movements, right? I make a point of bringing up the work I do, and I get the same reaction from all these young people. They're dumbfounded. They don't know what to say. And they'll invariably say something like, oh, well, that's not our issue. Well, okay, so the murder of the next generation isn't your issue. Okay. Then what kind of planet are you going to inherit?
But it is like, their issue, because the Vatican is completely part of the monetary system.
Right. It's the biggest corporation on the planet.
You know what I mean? They're all in bed with each other.
But, of course, the church funds a lot of these protest movements. And
that's
the Catholic Church funds every political party in Italy. Actually, every political party in the world gets Vatican subsidy. They get taxpayers' money from over 120 countries, including the United States, through these financial concordats. So, I mean, you know, the tentacles go everywhere.
You know, Kevin, two questions, and then I'll get back on track with the common law stuff, but I just had to ask you this. So, are each of the Catholic churches involved in ritual? You know, are each one of them, or is it like specific locations on specific, you know, sacred sites and land?
Yeah. There are specific churches. They're usually big cathedrals with underground catacombs or basements, sub-basement areas that are sealed off that most people don't know about. There's one, give you an example. There's a cathedral in Montreal, Canada, called Marie Reine de la Monde, which is Marie Mother of the World, or Queen of the World. And every August 15th, they have child sacrifice rituals there, according to an eyewitness. Also, they tend to do it at full moons and different satanic holidays. You know, they'll operate under the cover of youth groups or family activities going on in the church, and then these kids go missing. They always have cover stories. They have police involved. They have judges, compliant judges. It's a very broad network. And but, yeah, they use specific churches, definitely. And a lot of the people in the pews and a lot of the priests even don't, well, they don't want to know, put it that way.
Right.
They don't, that's the main, it's not that they don't know, they just.
Well, and I know you focus on the Catholic Church, you know, in particular, but my husband was the subject of severe sexual abuse throughout his childhood. And this was a, you know, non-denominational Christian church, completely, totally into the whole pedophilia. In fact, not only did he work as an usher for the church, not only did he work with the brigade boys, you know, his wife did too, with the girls. I mean, you know, that's what they do. That's their front. They completely embed themselves in these churches because it's like a little harvesting area for whatever children they want to, you know, focus their sights on.
That's true. It isn't, I mean, it's a general phenomena in religious groups. And you find this in non-Christian groups, too. We have reports all the time from, you know, Muslim and Jewish groups all over the world. Buddhist communities suffer from this. Because that's the last place people traditionally are going to look for that abuse going on.
Right.
You know, you think this is the people searching for God and truth and trying to help each other. And, you know, that's where the wolf can be among the fold, right?
Yeah. Well, and then my other question is, I'm curious, what do you feel is behind, what's the agenda behind this announcement that they made that they were going to come out on April 27th and discuss the UFOs and some sort of disclosure?
The Vatican, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's more distraction. I mean,
their
whole house of cards is coming down. Hence all the grandstanding with Obama showing up for the photo ops with the Pope and the Queen going down there. I mean, there's this whole new alliance forming on the earth, the you know, between Russia and China and the versus the West. And people are scrambling, you know, it's kind of like watching on the eve of World War One. All the alliances forming, people choosing sides. And the Vatican is there playing both sides. But they are in serious financial trouble, and they've been transferring lots of money out of the Vatican Bank recently to China, to German banks. And, you know, so, I mean, it's you've got to distract people when the system is in crisis. You've got to make it seem like, you know, things are in charge and the criminals are not really criminals. And, you know, all the stuff they're doing, that's an old Jesuit ploy. They've been doing it for centuries.
Yes, you're right. Okay, well, so we've talked about the rules of evidence. That's pretty clear cut. And then it says the court convenes when examination produces no settlement of differences.
Right.
Okay. So now we're going to go forth, right, and compile the case.
Right. You present the evidence, and usually in the case we've done so far, of course, the defendant never responded, and so they're tried at what's called in absentia. They're absent, but they can be. You know, they're given the opportunity to go to be present. If not, then the plaintiff can still present their evidence. And like I say, the nature of the evidence is really important. It's got to be thoroughly documented and not hearsay, you know, stuff we mentioned before.
Uh-huh. And then you also have to have some sort of relief sought. Can you go over that a little bit?
Well, that's usually in the statement of claim. You see, there's a claim of right, which kind of lays out the case. But then, usually in a court document, you lay out statement of claim in point form 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is the issue. This is the wrong that's happened. This is what I want. This is the resolution I want. And that's your case. And then you can call any witness. You can subpoena anybody. That's the power as well. A public summons is very, very potent in a common law case, because it's the main weapon the court has to bring people into court. And, you know, so, I mean, that whole procedure that the courts now are supposed to be following, but they don't. I mean, they don't even serve summonses anymore in a lot of the corporate courts, you know.
Yeah.
They have implied service where the person can say to the judge, yeah, I called them up and there's nobody at home. So, and the judge said, okay, consider him served. I mean, that's completely bogus, right? But that's how these courts operate.
Yeah, because they're operating within their own law.
Right, their own rules, not the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Not what's just, yeah.
No justice whatsoever. So it says here they claim the claim is accompanied by evidence and documents and testimonies that are always showing beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I had a question for you on that. So, for example, I mean, what if you got into a situation where there was some collusion, like, you know, three people against this one person and they just were out to get them? I mean, what are some of the checks and balances to prevent that from happening?
The main check and balance is the defendant can't turn over the case by not showing up. They can garner their own witnesses. They can show, and as a matter of fact, to show a conspiracy like that would weigh against, you know, one side, so it's really not advised normally. Even try something like that. But, I mean, no system is foolproof. If there's corruption going on, it can pervade any system. You know, but the normal check and balance is the jury itself, because, you know, 12 men and women looking at something, looking at the whole process of how it's presented, can normally tell whether something's true or not, whether somebody's been manipulated. You know, when you talk to somebody, you know whether they're lying or not. That's an inherent human capacity we have.
That's true.
And that's true in the jury, especially.
Okay, and so it says you have to provide original documents. That's not too difficult.
Original, not photocopies, that's right.
Photocopies.
Yeah.
And then it says those providing testimony must be willing to come into the court to testify and affirm it's their own statement. So they have to appear in the court of law.
Right, and normally that's, you know, you can get a notary to authorize that this is a genuine document, but normally without a notary, but people often don't know this, but you don't need a notarized document if you have three signatures.
Oh, wow.
So three people to testify something makes it a lawful document.
Now that does not apply, though, in this case, right? They have to actually physically appear.
Well, in the case of a pretty serious matter, yes, definitely.
Okay.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay, and then the plaintiff actually seeks their remedy, right? And this is interesting. So kind of like they've compiled their case, they've provided their evidence, And now what they do is they publish the notice of a claim of right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the claim of right comes right at the very beginning when you're gathering the jury. You have a right as a freeborn man or woman to defend yourself if you think you've been wronged. And there can't be any impediment put in the way of that by anybody. So you're given free. That's the beauty of the common law court. This is somebody who is taking action for justice in their own name. You're not relying on anybody to do it for you. And the courts are supposed to be convened to honor that and to allow that process to happen. So that's kind of the whole rationale for that.
Mm. Okay. So it's just they'll call for the community assistance and plaintiff's yeah. right to have the case heard. By peers and neighbors. That is just so cool. I mean, we're really literally going back to the old West.
That's right.
It's just so cool.
I mean, it goes back further than that. I mean, it's how village communities operated.
Yeah.
Before, you know, like you probably read stuff like they would have in the Middle Ages trial by ordeal where there was a dispute, you pick up swords, and whoever won, it was assumed God was on their side, therefore they were just. Or you'd have to grab a red-hot bar, and the one who had less burns on their hand meant God favored their case. I mean, that was the law in the Norman tradition.
Wow.
But Anglo-Saxon or tribal law said, no, people can just come together and decide for themselves, because we all know what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
That's natural law. That's born within us. It's not given to us or explained to us by a ruler, which is the Roman or papal or, you know, admiralty law system that we have to define for you what the truth is. You can't ever find it out by yourself. You need a judge. You need a pope. You need a politician. You need a priest. You need somebody to tell you what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
There's that way of looking at the world, or the other way, which is, no, we know what's right and wrong. We are the law. We are the government. We are the people. We the people. That's the first three words in the U.S. Constitution. We the people. There's God, there's the people, and then government under the people, not government over the people.
Do you remember, Kevin, the last time we talked, I brought up the Declaration of Independence?
Yeah.
I did a little more digging on that. Now, I just had to read this to you. You probably already know this, but, well, maybe you don't because you're Canadian, right?
I'm half American.
Well, you're American Canadian. We're all the same, right?
Yeah. Well, anyway, go on.
I remember a long time ago hearing this on a radio station, and I thought, you know, I got to find that article. I got to find it. It was driving me crazy. Anyway, it says here, out of the 56 men, okay, this is what happened. 9 died of wounds from war. 5 were captured and imprisoned brutally. Several lost their wives, their sons, and families. 1 lost all 13 of his children. 2 wives were brutally treated. Every single one of them was manhunted and driven from their homes.
Yep.
Okay. 12 had their homes. 12 had their homes completely burned down. 17 lost everything that they ever owned. And the bottom line was, not one of them retracted the pledge that they made.
And, beautiful.
You know, the Declaration of Independence, in my opinion, is one of the most beautiful documents ever written, you know?
That's right. And that's why, you know, there's a movement, actually, across America, this movement to restore the Republic, and that's exactly what they say, that we've got to move back from the de facto government now to the de jure government, which can come about through the grand jury system. Now, there were men, I met these men who are in prison right now for trying to do that. They were targeted by the FBI in exactly the way the British would target the signers of the Declaration, because they simply were standing on the common law and saying government is ruling arbitrarily, therefore we have the right under the Constitution to remove the government and replace it. It says that right in the Declaration.
Unbelievable. Well, I think things have been changing, though. I think the time is much riper now, and so many more of us. I mean, are you familiar with what's going on the Clive and Bundy ranch?
Yeah. I heard all the oath keepers got together and fought off the feds.
And they came back, you know, because the first time it was a victim. You know, the bottom line is, it's absolutely historical that they even left in the first place.
Yep.
So yes, there's still possibly a fight and a challenge, but people are starting to recognize that if they step up and they step into their power and they, you know, combine their forces with their fellow community members, they can get what they want.
That's right.
So, and this is part of it. This is so important. So back to the notice of the claim of right, you said basically at this point they're going to start gathering their jury. And they publish it in a local newspaper, right?
It could be not just a newspaper. You can post it in any public place, library, town hall, anything, just as long as it's public, a public notice.
Okay, and the public notice, it only has to be in one location?
Well, normally, I mean, historically, it would have to be in numerous places. They don't ever give a number, but the more people who know about it, the better, especially if you're trying to recruit a jury.
Okay. Now, let's talk about how do we form a common law court. So it says here, within 24 hours of the notice of claim of right, it is issued.
There's a number of ways. You can ask a sheriff to convene, or a justice of the peace. Again, those are locally elected officials. Again, the whole idea is it's coming from the community, accountable people, not some faraway, you know, cop or government person who isn't accountable. Or the people themselves can simply convene the 12 in the jury. And that's minimal 12. It doesn't have to stay at 12. The grand juries normally have 27, I think, people in it. But at that point, it's assumed that the people who are going to be working in certain roles will have a legal knowledge. For example, the adjudicator, who's kind of the advisor, not the judge, but the advisor to the jury, he has to have some kind of legal training or knowledge of at least the common law. And the plaintiff and defendant present their own case, so there's no lawyers involved. And the court officials, like, you know, bailiff, court reporter, the court record is very important. And the court record is a completely open public document. It cannot be changed by anybody. It's published immediately because it's invaluable. What goes on in the court is owned by the community. It's the people's court.
Right, and it's open
right.
Public disclosure. Go back for a second, Kevin. This is so important. Tell everybody why you do not involve a lawyer in this process, or, you know, anyone that's within the legal system.
Because the first thing the lawyer does is they take an oath to the court, and the court means the judge. So it's a buddy-buddy system. They're serving one another. And the classic case I had about that is the first case I was involved in, naming the United Church as being involved in child rape in these Indian residential schools. There were two eyewitnesses who wrote in their statement of claim that they found the dead bodies of children on the grounds of the Salburney Residential School. The lawyer removed that from their statement of claim. And I said, wait, why did you take that out? They didn't want that. They want that. I mean, they were traumatized at a young age finding these corpses of kids. They want that in their claim against the church. He said, this is a direct quote. The lawyer said, his name is Dave Patterson in Vancouver. He said, I am an officer of the court, and there's certain issues I'm not allowed to raise.
Yeah.
Unquote.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in other words, you can't name the Crown as having killed kids. Therefore, we're going to remove that. Who is he representing? He's representing the Crown, not his clients.
And that's what people do not realize. When they say they passed the bar, that's the
right.
Fish Accreditation Agent, Regency. Okay.
They passed the bar. They're inside on the helm of the deck of the ship.
Exactly.
They're on the other side of the bar. They're under admiralty law now, not common law.
Bingo.
Yeah.
So you basically have seven core officers. You have the court adjudicator, I'm sorry, the public prosecutor, the defense counsel, the court sheriff, the bailiff, the court registrar, and the court reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's the basic. I mean, there could be more. You know, depending on the complexity of the case and that, you can have, you know, other, like, for example, in a criminal case, you'd have a forensic team that would work with the court and that kind of thing. But otherwise, that's the basic structure.
Okay, so, Kevin, let's pretend like, you know, somebody's listening to this interview and they're really hot about going after the city for poisoning their water.
Right.
Okay, so what would be the first thing that they would do?
Gather the case. Make a case. Gather all the evidence, including the eyewitnesses. And that's the hard part, because most people don't want to come forward. When you're challenging the status quo, you lose friends very quickly. You make a lot of enemies even quicker. And you have to find a way. This is why you need outside support. You can never tackle a case on your own. You've got to do it in conjunction with groups outside who can come into the community, won't be as isolated and intimidated, and can help you. So it's really part of a bigger, you know, movement. This is why we're trying to do that with, like, the case of this guy who's in jail in South Dakota for challenging the fraudulent mortgages. It's got to be part of a whole bigger perspective.
Yeah, and you know, power is in numbers. So
yep.
That's, frankly, everybody listening, that's Kevin's and my goal, is to get us all unified and to be able to work together to get some action going to bring about the change with some of these bigger topics, you know, like the fluoride and that kind of thing.
You know, and there's kind of a middle step we need to take, you know, before actually even convening these courts. People have to be educated again. They've forgotten what liberty is. They've forgotten what the law is, and they have to be educated again in it. And unless we have that going on, people will not know what to do, even if you did convene a jury. You get these comments all the time, oh, are we allowed to do this?
Yeah.
Shouldn't we be consulting a lawyer? No. I mean, they've got to be educated in the liberty and in common law, and this is why we can set up in any community these educational groups to start doing that. Get it into the curriculum of schools. Get, meetings happening in the community saying this is the law. Come to our workshops and learn about it. We approach local sheriffs, and in South Dakota they've done that. They've got a few sheriffs to come to their common law workshops where they learn all these things. And one of these sheriffs said, I never knew any of this. They deliberately didn't teach us about the common law.
What?
Because they're only taught statute law. You enforce statutes. You gather money for the state. That's your role as a cop, right?
Wow.
But no, statute never trumps common law.
You know, I know a bunch of sheriffs, and they were very involved in their constitutionality and freedom. And, you know, that you'll notice that with sheriffs. They have a tendency to lean more that way than, say, a police officer.
That's right.
You know, because they're not imposing policy. They're actually working for supposedly the law.
Well, they're elected too. I mean, your average cop and soldier are not elected, and that, like judges or priests, when you're self-governing, you think you're God and you can do anything, and that's one of the sources of tyranny.
Well, so if somebody was going to get their feet wet, it might be better, you know, to start on something a little bit less zealous, like, you know, a next door neighbor that's, you know, knocking down their fence over and over again, something like that.
It's kind of like family law and divorce. It's something like that can get so heated and petty that it becomes really adversarial very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why often in civil matters they have it's often the case where a judge could step in and just mediate and say, okay, look, let's just sit down and work this out. You don't need a jury. Let's just work it out, right? So you often find juries happening in more serious cases than civil matters, which can be just worked out when people calm down and just it's easy to work things out between a couple of people. Juries are needed when it's involving much more serious matters like murder or something threatening the community or children or anything like that.
Hmm. And have you found the sheriffs necessary for this whole operation? Have you found them to be fairly receptive these days?
Well, not at first, because people are always also worrying about their job and their pension and is this lawful and everything. But you find a few that are leading this, that are saying, yeah, it's not only lawful, but it's a way to recover what the American Republic should be, and through that, what, well, you know, a light is needed in the world again. I mean, I really believe that America was a light in the world for humanity. Yeah. And there was a covenant going on there. Yeah. You know, it was said right there in the founding charter that there's a covenant between God and the American people to bring in this for humanity. When you violate the covenant, all bets are off, and you got to say, okay, we got to build it again. It's that simple.
Yeah,
so that's part of what we're doing.
I love the fact that the United States is an amalgamation of every race, creed, and color. You know what I mean? It's just, it's an, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We are so unique in that way. So I know we're getting close to the 1.5 hour time mark. And we have so much more to go over. Is it okay to do this again with you?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, when I'm over in Europe this next week, we'll have a lot more new stuff to report about how the court case is going on child trafficking against the so-called Pope and these other people. So we have a lot to report. I'll connect on Skype with you.
Okay.
And we can arrange an interview. But just to remind people, itccs.org. And the Common Law Court actually has a website. The International Common Law Court of Justice is iclcj.com, iclcj.com.
And Kevin, tell everybody the significance of the International Court of Justice. How does that fit into this whole process?
Well, it's kind of an umbrella for these common law courts everywhere. It's the mother, I guess, of a lot of this thing was set up initially 4 years ago to be an example of how citizens can convene their own courts and have it can have lawful standing under international law. So it's operating in Brussels, but again, under a lot of security because of the attacks they're facing. And there's a Belgian member of parliament who's just named the prime minister there as a child rapist. And, you know, I'll be meeting with him this week, and we're going to hopefully have a press conference where we'll be looking into how wide this child trafficking is spreading.
Wow. I know that they issued some pretty major rulings. I mean, weren't they responsible for putting out the notice of George Bush committing crimes against humanity?
Well, another common law court did that. It was called the Kuala Lumpur Citizens Tribunal. People have the right to form their own what are called tribunals of conscience that have standing under the law. So like other courts can take their verdicts and enforce them, issue arrest warrants.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, these are not just symbolic decisions. They have legal weight behind them. And that's why I mentioned early in the interview that, you know, the police are really concerned about these stand-down orders. They know that they're obeying criminal authorities, and they can be called for it. They can be arrested. We can perform citizen's arrest on anybody colluding with a criminal in high office. So all of that is in our hands if we choose to exercise it or not.
I just think this is fabulous. And let's, Kevin, let's tell them we have been talking about putting a workshop together in the Southern California area. And Kevin and I are going to work together on that to really,
yep.
I just feel like time is now for us to really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll be back mid to late May. I plan to come down after a little rest. I plan to come down during the summer and probably into the fall too, down the West Coast. So we will definitely work on that. We had a whole number of citizen jurors from California and the southern states in our first case, you know, volunteer.
Good.
So there's a lot of interest in that part of the world. And yeah, I look forward to coming down there.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very successful. So everybody stay tuned and just continue to support Kevin. Again, please visit his website at itccs.org. Do you have a donation button up there, Kevin?
Yeah, there's a PayPal button on the site, and it's the only way that I get around. It's totally community funded.
Okay, cool. So please support him. This is so much bigger than just child molestation, even though that is an atrocity that we want to stop on this planet. But this is just so much bigger. If we really truly want to dismantle this maniacal matrix, this is one of the men to support. So, Kevin, I honor you once again, and I thank you for your time tonight. And, you know, we are so, I think we're so grateful to have you already knowing. I mean, think about it. You went through this and worked with the common law court with one of the most difficult cases out there. And you're having fabulous success. You know, that should be enough to spearhead all of us to get going.
I think so. And I think that that's important to show that, well, if we can bring down that guy, then we can bring down anybody. So I hope that's an encouragement to people.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
So everybody, thank you so much for listening. We're going to make it an early night. And God bless everybody. I love you all. And we will talk to you next time. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.